This is Jim Inkster. Coming today, we'll visit with David Kerpius, Associate Vice Chancellor for Enrollment Management at LSU. He has the latest on a collaboration with Baton Rouge Community College and much more about what's occurring on the campus of the old War School. Also with us is David Orentlicker. He is the Samuel Rosen Professor at the Indiana University School of Law. He has written a book saying there should be a bipartisan executive branch, a conservative and a liberal, together running the country. The book is Two Presidents Are Better Than One. Also, Chesley Himesfield on the Louisiana International Film Festival coming this way very soon. And we'll hear from Alyssa Altman. Her book is Poor Man's Feast, a love story of comfort, desire, and the art of simple cooking. Now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Kevin Gallagher producing, and good morning and happy Monday. And David Kerpius, the man who was Associate Dean of the Manship School for many years and has now moved to another capacity at LSU. He's still with the Manship School, but he is the Vice Chancellor for Enrollment Management. He is with us, along with his counterpart at Baton Rouge Community College, Monique Cross, and they are here first and foremost to talk about a collaboration between LSU and BRCC called Tiger Bridge. Let's begin with you, Professor Kerpius. What is the Tiger Bridge?
Well, the Tiger Bridge came out of an effort to find a pathway for students who we know will be successful ultimately in getting their four-year degree. And because of the state regulations on how we take in students and the level at which we take in students, some of these students, high school students, just miss that mark. And so we went around the country and looked at different models for this. And a group of us went to South Carolina. Actually, Clemson University has one of the best programs in the country, and they were nice enough to take care of us. And so we went and looked at what they were doing, and we were very impressed. They are taking in students, working with the community college, so the students live and have experiences on the Clemson campus. At Clemson, they live just off campus, and they take their courses at the community college that's nearby. And so what we were impressed with is that this did a good job of helping students transition into college life. There was lots of academic support and tutoring there.
Well, so the students will actually live on the LSU campus?
They will. They'll live in McVoy Residence Hall, which is a living learning residence hall that is basically across the street from the Union.
And will have access to LSU facilities? They can use a rec center and a library and all that good stuff?
They will. They absolutely will. They will have a student ID. The only difference on their LSU student ID is that under the picture it'll say Bridge Student, and but it looks like everybody else's ID. The two things that they do not have access to is they cannot be involved in Greek life for that year, and they cannot be a leader in a student organization. But most freshmen don't lead those organizations anyway, so that's not a big deal.
It starts this fall. Do they get access to Tiger football tickets?
That actually was one of the first questions that people started asking, and my assumption was no, and I went over and talked to the athletic department, kind of expecting that they would say, no, we're sold out. And they said, actually, I think we can make those available for some games. And so they won't have all of the games, but what they will have is access to some tickets. And then what I was really interested in is that they'll be able to go in the student marketplace online, and they will be able to buy tickets for other games from other students who got them at the student rate.
All right. 297-5633 if you'd like to join the conversation with David Kerpius of LSU and Monique Cross of Baton Rouge Community College. This Tiger Bridge program will start this fall. Students at BRCC will have access and will actually be living on the LSU campus. Now, Monique, how does this help BRCC?
I think it's great for the community college as well, because it just strengthens the partnership with LSU. Students can start their college journey in smaller classrooms, have very intense advising, tutoring, and it'll get them on the path to their success for the remainder of their career at LSU.
How many students are we talking about?
We have space for 184 students in McVoy Residence Hall. I am negotiating to get a few more in the neighboring Acadian Hall. We'll see how that goes. But so far the answer has been no, but I think that there's possibly a chance for that. I do want to clarify one thing. To be considered, students must apply to LSU. This year they'll be denied, and then we come back and we'll send out an invitation. And those invitations for this coming fall will go out tomorrow morning.
So you already have a list of people you're going to invite?
The list will be generated this afternoon, and we have the parameters for that list determined. And so, yes, we're going to invite between 600 and 700 students to this. We know that the acceptance rate is somewhere around a third. Once invited, it's a first-come, first-serve priority list. But I would encourage people to, if they don't get in the first try, that they should absolutely be on the waiting list, because I see dynamic movement in that. And if a student does a great job this spring and becomes eligible to be normally admitted to LSU, we will move them to normal admission to LSU, and we will move someone off the wait list into the Bridge.
Upon successful completion of 30 hours of transferable college-level coursework with a cumulative LSU transfer grade point average of at least 2.5, the people involved in the Tiger Bridge program, what happens at that point?
They don't have to do anything. They meet with their academic advisors at LSU, and they will be a regularly admitted sophomore at LSU, which is to say no new application, no additional application fee. If they do what they're supposed to do, they're going to become an LSU student.
You've been at BRCC for a decade?
Close to a decade, yes.
10 years? How's it working as far as those students advancing to LSU or some other school and getting a degree?
I think it's working really well. We have articulation agreements that are established with the transfer schools, and that has certainly paved a path for students to move towards their four-year degree. The beauty of this Tiger Bridge is that students, once they complete that 30 hours, they move on to LSU with successful completion according to the criteria for the program. But once they complete the next 30 hours at LSU, those credits will transfer back to BRCC, and BRCC will be able to award an associate degree on their journey towards their bachelor's degree.
Now, Donna asks, how many students are currently enrolled at BRCC?
There's close to 8,000 students enrolled at BRCC.
So about one-third the size of the LSU campus at BRCC. That's a lot. And when you consider that there's only space for 184 right now, I would imagine you may have more people inclined to do this than you have ability to fulfill at this point.
That potentially could be an issue, but I know that we're looking to expand the housing on the LSU campus, and as we're able to expand that housing capacity, then we certainly could expand the enrollment in the program.
All right. So, David, how does it work? Does somebody try to enroll at LSU, and then they're offered this option? Is that what happens?
That's exactly right. So there will be an invitation that comes out, and I encourage those who get the invitation to act quickly. There's a website, tigerbridge.lsu.edu, where there are frequently asked questions out there, so you can get more information about it. But in the lower right-hand corner, there's the accept your invitation, and then it goes to a list of all the things they have to do, which there are five things, and they go and do that. But I would encourage them to do it quickly, because I think that there's going to be a lot of interest in this. And quite honestly, if we had the housing at LSU to do this, we would expand the program beyond this point. But what we don't want to do is to negatively impact the regularly enrolled students at LSU. And so to get this space, we're renovating some space in Kirby Smith Residence Hall to offset it. So it doesn't affect the LSU students.
I lived in Kirby Smith for a few years. Tallest building on campus. That was a little while ago.
It is.
But it was a fine place. Now, you've been at LSU 16 years.
I have.
And as I stated, most of that time in the Manship School, where you're still a professor. But what's going on with, I hear the Reveille's about to sue the university. Is that going to happen?
I don't know. I actually haven't talked to the fine people over there. And it's a great school, and, I'm obviously supportive of student journalists cutting their teeth and going after tough issues. And there's been a history of that at the Reveille. And so,
yeah, going back to the Huey Long days.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so, and we've had great journalists come out of there. I mean, Ginger Gibson is at mm-hmm. Politico now, and you see her chasing the president and vice president around and asking tough questions, and actually had to laugh. She was trying to ask some questions at a news conference recently and had this bright orange baseball cap on, and you know, Ginger always sticks out. So,
well, she was on this show. She covered Mitt Romney during his campaign for the presidency and said he gave her a birthday cake and all that good stuff on the campaign plane, but she's now covering President Obama, isn't she?
Yeah, she is. Well, she Mitt Romney better be careful, because Ginger's not one to take cakes lightly. She's going to ask the tough questions
no matter what. Just probably encourages
Yeah, that's right.
But the Reveille is upset that LSU has not been forthcoming in releasing the names of the candidates to be president slash chancellor of LSU, and the word is that the students are going to take on the administration in court. This is one to follow. Now, David Kerpius is on the board of directors for the Louisiana Association of Broadcasters, as am I, and we're following this tax proposal for the governor, from the governor, that will presumably be revealed on Friday with interest. It could include a media tax.
I think that's a dangerous place to be, because it certainly works against helping the broadcasters in this state do the good commerce that they do and keep these important shows on the air. Minnesota actually was thinking about doing that. They've reconsidered, and I believe that bill's been pulled back.
It has.
And Florida was also considering it. I actually don't know the status of that bill.
I don't think Florida's going to do it, but there's one other state that is considering it, Ohio. And at this point, Louisiana, we'll wait and see. But Tim Barfield, who runs the Department of Revenue, was on the show last week. He says it's under consideration, as are many other things, including rights fees to LSU sports. It could be an interesting proposal that the governor releases this Friday.
Well, you know, I think we're all waiting to see what he's going to release and how he's going to make up for the lost revenue that comes from changing from one form of taxation to another. And, you know, at the end of the day, the money's got to mm-hmm. work, and you have to be able to support things like universities and the infrastructure that allows us to live a good life in this state.
It would put the media in an interesting spot if this were to happen, because as people are covering the news, they don't like to become advocates. But in this case, some might have to become advocates for their own salvation.
Absolutely. I mean, it's there are some issues in media where the media itself gets thrown into the spotlight, and it does make it difficult to cover. Mm-hmm. But this is interesting, because it has the potential to hamper the free flow of information, which is so important to the society in which we live. And so if it does happen, I think it'll be one that will be important to follow, will be important to have good conversations about, and to try and figure out exactly where we should mm-hmm. be on this issue.
With all the budget cuts that are taking place in higher education, what's the mood on the LSU campus right now?
You know, actually, the mood's been pretty good lately. We just had some of our prospective high-performing students on campus, and they were very excited about the opportunities. I still see great students coming through classes that are run by great professors, and so the experience is still there. I can tell you that my trash doesn't get emptied in my office every day or every other day, and there are fewer janitorial services, fewer landscaping crews around campus. And so there has been a negative impact on the campus, but I think the student enterprise and the learning opportunities remain.
And at BRCC?
I think that, you know, we certainly could echo what Dave is saying. You know, we all have to learn to do with the budget that we have, and the main focus is continuing to provide that quality education for the students.
Thank you, Monique Cross, BRCC, David Kerpius, Louisiana State University. We'll be back with David Oertlicker. He says we should have two presidents of the United States. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number outside our area. It is 877-217-5757. You may also reach us via email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. We're joined now by Professor David Oertlicker. He is the Samuel Rosen Professor at the Indiana University School of Law, a scholar of constitutional law, and a former state representative. He's also taught at Princeton and the University of Chicago Law Schools. He has received degrees in law and medicine at Harvard and specializes in healthcare law and ethics, and has written a book stating that we should have two presidents. Two presidents are better than one. That's the title, The Case for a Bipartisan Executive Branch. Good morning, Professor Oertlicker.
Good morning.
Why should we have two presidents of the United States?
Well, there are several reasons. One is it's a way to fix the partisan conflict that just causes all gridlock in Washington and prevents members of Congress from dealing with our high budgets and budget deficits and that led to the sequester just most recently. But time after time, we end up with crises as President Obama. We careen from crisis to crisis, and Congress just is unable to deal with it. And most people's view is that Congress is the problem, that we need to change the way we draw districts, the gerrymandering is what's driving it. But in fact, the high levels of polarization are really driven by what scholars have called the development of an imperial presidency. Over the past 75 years, the White House has accumulated more and more power. So the president has become the dominant elected official in our country and indeed the world, because America is the most powerful country. And so what we see is every 4 years we see hundreds of millions of dollars spent on winning the White House. And then as soon as the election's over, the parties renew their battle to position themselves for the next election. And so if you've got a Republican president, Democrats in Congress try to frustrate the president so they can win back the White House. If you've got a Democrat in the White House, Republicans try to, in the words of former Senator DeMint, try to break. The Republicans' goal is to break the Obama administration so they could win back the White House. And what we need to do is, instead of having this winner-take-all election every 4 years that drives this partisan conflict, we need to give both parties a stake in the White House so that we encourage cooperation rather than conflict.
Now, how would that work with a Democrat and a Republican both serving as president?
Well, it would be very important if you're going to have shared power, and we know this from experiences in other countries, if you're going to do a shared power arrangement, they have to be equals who operate by consensus. You can't have any ability for one of them to gain dominance, because if one can gain the upper hand, they'll just spend all their time fighting for who's in control, just like we see the parties fighting now for who's in control in Washington. It has to be clear that they will always have a 50-50 relationship while they're serving, and after the next election, it'll still be a 50-50 relationship. And if you set it up that way, then their incentive will be to cooperate, because presidents, you know, they've reached the pinnacle of political life. And once they've reached the top, their goal is to have a record of accomplishment. They want to leave a legacy. That's what drove President Obama to work on health care, even though the economy was struggling, because health care was going to be his legacy. Or when George Bush took us into Iraq, a big part of that was to bring democracy to the Middle East. So this drive to leave a legacy will be very important, and presidents will understand either they work with their partner and leave a legacy, or they fight with their partner and get nothing done. And they don't want to leave the White House with a record, nothing accomplished.
Douglas Brinkley, of the formerly of the University of New Orleans, says a well-researched and creative look at how to break the shackles of Washington gridlock instead of accepting the status quo of our checks and balance system. He, Professor Oertlicker, rethinks the wheel of executive power. Now, how would we do this with elections
Well, everybody would still have one vote, but instead of one person being the winner and getting all the power, you'd have the top two candidates sharing the White House. So it would ordinarily be a Democrat and Republican, but it would actually make it more feasible for third-party candidates because it's almost impossible to win as a third-party candidate. We've never had it, but running second is more feasible. And so it gives a chance for third-party candidates, but the top two vote-getters would become the co-president. So currently, after an Obama Romney election, you would have Mitt Romney and Barack Obama sharing the White House. And you know, the important thing here is Barack Obama got about 52% of the vote, but he got 100% of the power. And under my proposal, he would get 50% of the power after 52% of the vote, and Mitt Romney would get 50% of the power after about 48% of the vote. And instead of having half of the public feeling like they have no voice and disempowered and inclined to oppose whatever comes out of the White House, all of the public would feel like the person they prefer is in the White House and working on policies. And we would have bipartisan initiatives emerge from the White House that would garner the support from across the political spectrum. And if you had members of Congress who were inclined to toward obstruction just for obstruction's sake, not on the merits, it's fine to oppose because you think it's wrong on the merits. But when you block things just because it's the person from the other party, that's wrong. And when you have bipartisan initiatives coming out of a White House, there no longer will be a partisan position of obstruction. And so I think it will do a lot to dampen and diffuse the partisan conflict.
297-5633 or 877-217-5757. Professor David Oertlicker, who's a constitutional lawyer, his book is Two Presidents Are Better Than One, The Case for a Bipartisan Executive Branch from New York University Press. Now, this would obviously be a constitutional change. As you know, those are not easy to get done. How in the world would you ever achieve something like this?
Well, we would need a constitutional amendment, and those are difficult, but there are a few reasons why I think it's feasible. One is people are disgusted with what's going on in Washington. You know, congressional approval ratings have sunk as low as 10% in the past year. So the public is very unhappy with the way things are working, and members of Congress are too. They don't like the partisan conflict that they face on a daily basis, and so you see a lot of senators. One of my senators, Evan Bayh from Indiana, retired because it was getting too unpleasant. Olympia Snowe from Maine. So members of Congress don't like it, and so we see a strong groundswell of interest in having a more bipartisan governing. So I think that's an important reason why. The other thing is it's more what the framers wanted. You know, their view was they understood we'd have one. You know, they expected one president, but they expected the president to represent everybody because the president's constituency is the whole country, not just one state or one congressional district. And George Washington was exactly that kind of president. He didn't represent just his party or Virginia or whatever other interest groups that were there in that time. His view was, I represent the entire public. Well, today, our presidents don't do that. They represent their party. And by bringing both parties into the White House, we'll actually bring our presidency much closer to what the framers wanted, which was an executive branch that represented the entire country.
What happens when the presidents disagree?
Well, one of the important things is that the presidents will have to agree before they can take action, before they sign a bill passed by Congress, before they issue an executive order, before they take us into a foreign country like Syria or Libya, send our military, they have to agree. And so that make, you know, they'll have to do two things. One is they'll have to reach policies that have a broad consensus. They can't just ram policies through that have support from only half the country. The other thing is we know from research on decision-making, economists and psychologists have studied how do people make decisions and what's the best way to do that. And what they find is You know, the old adage is really true. Two heads are better than one. That when you have people with different perspectives trying to solve difficult problems, they do a better job than individuals alone, because when you bring people together who have different viewpoints, you know, they'll necessarily think of things in different ways, and by having different approaches, you get better results overall. So we might not have as many actions coming out of the White House, but overall we'll have better actions. And the bad decisions, we're less likely to have those that can cause a lot of harm.
Liz in Prairieville asks, who becomes the First Lady?
Well, it is interesting that we'll have not only two presidents, but two vice presidents and two first ladies. We'll only have one cabinet member for each position. So here's another, that's another important thing. You know, all those bitter confirmation battles that we see, that we just saw with Chuck Hagel and that we see with Supreme Court justices, those will disappear, because you can't, you won't be able to have a nominee for Secretary of Defense or Secretary of State or the Supreme Court unless both of the presidents agree. And what you'll get is nominees that are more moderate and that are, have appeal to both sides of the political spectrum. And instead of having these long, drawn-out confirmation battles, people will be appointed very quickly, and they'll take their positions, and we won't have all these unfilled offices in the executive branch and in the judiciary that, that make it hard for the government to do its job.
David Orenlicher is our guest. He is a professor at the Indiana University School of Law and a scholar of constitutional law, and he has a whopper of a constitutional change that he is offering. Two presidents are better than one, the case for a bipartisan executive branch. Would you think this would be a good idea to be replicated on the state level, maybe have two governors for every state?
Well, that's an interesting. Should we do it with governors, too? I think it probably would be a good idea in many cases. I will say the argument is not quite as strong. One of the important reasons why I think it will work at the national level is because we have, you know, we're very closely balanced between Democrats and Republicans. It's almost 50-50. And if you're going to break, share the power 50-50, that's, the public needs to be in about a 50-50 balance. In a lot of states, they, you have a strong Democratic, you know, constituency or strong Republican, and then so as it gets less balanced, the case is weaker. Also, governors don't have the immense power of the presidency, so it's not as big a problem to give one person that power. But the other advantage of having governors do it is it's a way to test things out. You know, there's a famous expression from former Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis about states being a lot we can have this, the laboratory of state experimentation. If we want to try out a new idea, better to do it on a smaller scale first. So if we try it out in some states like Iowa or Missouri or Wisconsin that are closely balanced, then we can see, does it work? How well does it work? And if it seems to work well at the state level, then we can be more confident to try it out in the national level.
Now, the, another point made by listener Annie is that what happens if two Republicans run one and two in the presidential election, or two Democrats? What happens at that point?
Yes, it would be very important that the two people come from different parties. So
but
that
that's, not,
party
a, that's
would,
not a guarantee if it's an open process, is it?
Well, it would be structured, so it would be the top two vote-getters from different parties. Each party could only nominate one person. You could only have one Democrat nominee from the Democratic Party, only one nominee from the Republican Party. So, yes, it would be very important that they come from different parties, and the constitutional amendment would have to be written so that you couldn't have two people from the same party. That would not be possible. And because you're right, if you ended up with two Democrats or two Republicans, it wouldn't work out exactly.
And who lives in the White House?
Well, I think it would be important that they share the White House, and so you'd have to turn some of the guest quarters into living quarters. One of the reasons, you know, when you look at the research on how what leads people who to cooperate rather than fight, because, you know, people sometimes if they, you know, don't work together, they can get their preferences passed all the way and rather than having to compromise. And what we know is the people tend to cooperate when they're equals. As I've said, they have to be equal. that they have an ongoing relationship so that they have to work together, make many decisions. If they only have to make one decision together, then there's a real incentive to try to get exactly what you want because it's a one-time thing. And the example I like to use is the relationship you have with the car dealer is not nearly as pleasant as the relationship you have with the person who services your car, because the person who services your car knows you're going to be back on a regular basis, and they want you to come back. When you're buying a car, the person may never see you again because you may not be buying a car for another 5 or 10 years. But presidents in a co-presidency will have to make decisions together on a daily basis over a period of years. And so that's important. And so by putting them in the White House, they'll have frequent contact with each other. They'll be making decisions. And that's the kind of relationship that leads people to cooperate.
Mm-hmm. Now, in every facet of society in America, we tend to have somebody who's in charge. This would change that concept a great deal, wouldn't it?
It would. And, you know, there's been an evolution in a lot of different places about that. We used to, in the doctor-patient relationship, the doctor used to be in charge and make all the decisions. And we found over time that it works better when doctors and patients share decisions. In the family, the father and the husband used to make all the decisions, and we found that it works better when the husband and wife share the decisions. And corporations are seeing the same thing, too. There used to be a belief that a single person in charge worked best, but there are a lot of corporations that are coming to the recognition that shared leadership works better, too. And here's an important reason why I think the founding fathers would feel the same way. Because when they drew up our government, the idea was that Congress, which would be a deliberative body where you'd have many different officials with different perspectives, they would sit together and decide, what's our policy going to be? How do we improve education? Or how do we improve the economy? Or how do we increase our energy exploration? And once they deliberated with their different perspectives and came up with the best policy, they'd send it over to the president to implement it. And when you have somebody just implementing policy made by Congress, you want somebody, a single person who's decisive and not having to spend a lot of time conferring mm-hmm. with others.
Here's a question I want to get in before we leave our conversation with Professor Ortlicker. Jason in Metairie writes, so when the two presidents disagree, he says, wouldn't everything operate the same as it does now with President Obama and President Boehner?
Well, in fact, it would work a lot better, and here's why. When you look at when Obama and Boehner try to work something out together, they actually do a pretty good job. The problem is when Boehner has to take it back to his caucus and then try to get the agreement of everybody else. If you have two people with relatively equal power trying to work it out, they can find common ground. There's ample common ground. It's when you try to bring it back to a group of people who have different interests and are maneuvering for their own power.
David Ortlicker, he is the author of Two Presidents Are Better Than One, The Case for a Bipartisan Executive Branch. Thank you, Professor. And thank you. We'll be back with Chesley Himesfield. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number, and we're in studio with Chesley Himesfield. She is the person behind the Louisiana International Film Festival, which is coming this way very soon. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Well, this is your baby, and you've been doing it for how many years now?
Well, we've been around for about a year now. I actually moved down to Louisiana about 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And when I first came down here, after working for many years as a producer and writer for film and television in New York and L.A., I very quickly realized there was a lot of potential here in this state for film. So I just wanted to get involved and be a part of this movement.
Well, the event starts officially at what time?
Well, our actual signature event, which is the Louisiana International Film Festival, this is our first year. It's going to be April 18th through the 21st of 2013, so it's coming up very shortly. And what we're going to do is a prelude to that is actually showcase a free screening of Searching for Sugar Man, which, as you may know, actually just won the Academy Award for Best Documentary Feature. And we're very lucky that Sony Pictures Classics is letting us host this free screening for the community. So that's going to be this Wednesday, actually on March 13th at 7 o'clock at the LSU Union Theater. And we would love to invite everyone in the community to come and join. There are plenty of seats, and we want to see everyone there. And while people are in the audience, we can also let them know about how to get involved in the festival coming up in April.
That's Searching for Sugar Man this Wednesday, 7 o'clock, LSU Union Theater. You say no charge, too.
So that's right. No charge, especially for you, Jim.
Well, thank you. That's a great place to do something like this as well. Mm-hmm. Now, when the film festival takes place in April, you'll have people from literally all over the world on hand. Who are some of those that are on tap as far as visitors to our city?
Well, we have a lot of interesting characters who are going to be visiting us. Actually, one of them you've interviewed previously. One of our co-artistic directors is Jeff the Dude Dowd from The Big Lebowski, which just had its 15th year anniversary. And he helped to start the Sundance Institute, and we're very fortunate to have him on board helping us with this festival. Also, our another co-artistic director is Dan Ireland, and he's a very well-known, actually, who you saw downtown with us, Jim. He's a very well-known director in independent film, and he's known for starting some careers of incredible starlets like Renee Zellweger and Jessica Chastain. And so having people as part of our team who've helped to discover talent, I think, is really vital for this festival. One of the main reasons that I started it was to try and find where the talent is, who the talent is in the state, be able to congregate everyone in one place so that we have access to opportunity through networking. And we're also going to be hosting a producers conference and industry expo on April 19th. On Friday during our festival, and that will be over at Celtic Studios during the day. So anyone who's directly or indirectly affiliated with the film industry can actually come and get a booth and be able to, again, congregate and for commerce and creativity.
Well, this is part of the renaissance of film in this area. We have become quite a haven for the industry, haven't we?
You absolutely have. Actually, there's a long and grand tradition of storytelling and filmmaking in Louisiana, and there's a confluence of many factors that make this a very strong environment right now to be able to start a unique film festival that's a statewide event that's actually being held here in Baton Rouge primarily. And so, as you know, Beasts of the Southern Wild, which we actually held a pre-release screening for, which the entire cast attended in July, they were just nominated for an Academy Award. And also the Fantastic Flying Books and Mr. Morris Lesmore actually won an Academy Award for Best Animated Short Film the year prior, and that's from filmmakers up in Shreveport. So there's just all this incredible indigenous filmmaking that's taking place, and Louisiana has a great international reputation for it. So there's really no better time to be able to host a signature event for Louisiana than right now.
Well, Chesley Himesfield is moved here from Atlanta to lead this production, and you've done quite a job.
Well, thank you very much, and we hope to see you down there.
Well, and Wednesday night, it begins unofficially with Searching for Sugar Man at the LSU Union Theater, 7 o'clock, no charge. And we'll follow this as we get closer, and I'm impressed that you came this way from the big city of Atlanta.
And people can also actually RSVP to Searching for Sugar Man on our website at lifilmfest.org. And, you know, we hope that everyone can get involved in all kinds of ways. Volunteer, buy an all-access pass that's currently available for a short amount of time until April 1st. We only have a few that we're selling. So I want to encourage everyone to jump on that as much as they can. Also, on March 15th, actually, the director from Beasts of the Southern Wild, Ben Zeitland, and also an incredible Louisiana director, Glenn Petrie, is also going to be here at LSU on the 15th as well.
This Friday.
That's right. So we got a lot of things happening this week.
Where are they going to be?
They're going to be at the Dalton Woods Auditorium, and that's from 7 to 9 at LSU.
7 to 9 p.m., I would.
That's correct. Hopefully not in the morning. That
Friday
wouldn't be
night,
good for filmmakers.
The Ides of March. Okay. Well, thank you, Chesley, and let's stay in touch.
Thank you.
Take care. And we're joined now by Alyssa Altman. She is quite a writer, lives in Connecticut with Susan Turner, and A Small Herd of Animals, and she's written quite a book about food, Poor Man's Feast, a love story of comfort, desire, and the art of simple cooking. Alyssa has been described as the illegitimate love child of David Sedaris. Good morning, Alyssa.
Good morning. Good morning. How are you? Thank you so much for having me.
Well, nice to talk with you. That's quite a description.
I suppose if David's listening, I'm sure he's getting a chuckle out of it.
He has been on this show, and I'm sure he would get a chuckle out of it. And you have been described as being somewhat irreverent at times, as is he, as we know. When you're talking about food, you've got quite an array of ideas that could be offered, and many of them are offered in Poor Man's Feast. And this starts with you and Susan. You meet her, and you say it changed your world in a few ways, but particularly with food. How so?
Well, Susan is the kind of person who can just put a poached egg on a piece of toast and make the egg perfectly and make the toast perfectly and have it be just an extraordinary small meal. And she is born and raised in Connecticut. I'm a New Yorker. I come from Manhattan, and I grew up at a time in Manhattan where food was always tall. It was big and tall, and I think everybody knows what I mean when I say tall food, the kind of vertically plated fancy dishes that you look at it and you don't really know how to eat it, whether you should knock it over first before before slicing into it. And you basically need sort of a degree in deconstructive architecture in order to eat it. And for some reason, I think probably because that was the trend when I was growing up in New York, I aspired to cook that way in my own home. And I did that for many, many years. And so when I met Susan and she basically let me know in no uncertain terms that I had it all wrong, everything changed.
So she won the battle.
She won the battle, absolutely. Well, she always wins the battle, but yes, absolutely.
How did it change for you?
Well, I realized that food doesn't need to be fancy, and that very often the best way to eat and the best way to entertain is simply and with a certain purity of ingredients. If you use the best ingredients that you can find, you really don't need to do anything to it beyond cook it. You don't need to plate it vertically. You don't need to stuff it into a timbale mold or kind of beat it into submission.
Well, there are some recipes, about 26 of them, that are offered in Poor Man's Feast. And I would think that almost all of these, if not all of them, occurred after you and Susan began your collaboration.
That's correct, and if I had included recipes that from my earlier days in the kitchen, they probably would have taken up the expanse of the whole book just by virtue of their complex nature.
What are some of those that you're most proud of that you'd like to share with the masses?
I think certainly. For example, I talk about our first Christmas together, and one of the dishes that I made was a very, very simple braised lamb shank. And, St. Patrick's Day is coming up, I know, and lamb is a very, very popular meat around St. Patrick's Day. And it was just very, very simple. It's an inexpensive cut. It used to be considered a throwaway cut by many butchers. And we just browned it and cooked it down with some wine and vegetables and at a low temperature, and it was extraordinary.
Alyssa Altman is the guest, the winner of the 2012 James Beard Award for Individual Food Blog. Now, when you're blogging about food, you're writing all the time about it, aren't you?
I am writing all the time about it, indeed. And my blog is a little bit different than what a lot of people expect when they go to a place like Epicurious or some of the other really wonderful food blogs out there. It's really more of a narrative style. It's long form, so it tends to be a little bit under 1,000 words each entry, and some entries do have recipes, some entries don't have recipes, and it's really all about what's happening in my life at any given moment.
It is amazing, Alyssa, how many people are writing about food right now. It's probably one of the most fertile areas for description in the world, and to get people's attention, you have to write a compelling work, which you have done.
Thank you so much.
Poor Man's Feast is the book from Chronicle Books, a love story of comfort, desire, and the art of simple cooking. One reviewer says, it's a pleasure to get to live both at Altman's joyously, irreverently laid table with two overlapping love stories. And there are two overlapping love stories here.
Yes, yes. I mean, I think that that you can certainly look at it in that one love story. One half of the story is my love affair with food and the table and feeding people and learning how to cook simply. And of course, the other love story is my meeting someone who would change it all for me.
How has Susan responded to all this attention you're getting?
Well, she's by nature very shy, so she's kind of chuckling at it and enjoying it, and she's a big food lover and a big book lover. So I think that that she's enjoying it. She reads absolutely everything I write from the minute I write it. Nothing escapes her eye. She's a wonderful critic and a great editor and a kind editor. So that's nice.
The book tour that you're on is quite ambitious. I see you're just back from Philadelphia, and to give you an idea of how talking about this is not a one-shot deal by any means for Alyssa, I see you'll be in Santa Barbara, then San Francisco. This is all in March, by the way. Santa Barbara, San Francisco, Portland, Seattle, Ann Arbor, Minneapolis, Chicago, Cambridge, Massachusetts, New York City, Wellesley, Boston, and Iowa City, all in the month of March. So you'll be exhausted by the time this month ends.
You know, it looks really wonderful on paper, but I think you're probably right. I think I'm going to probably be exhausted by the time it's all over. But I'm really, really looking forward to meeting a lot of the fans of the blog who are promising to come out and finally putting faces to names and to shaking some hands and signing some books. And nothing makes me happier than speaking with my readers up close and personal.
Here's a question from Sharon. How do you balance good tasting food with healthy menus?
I think it all comes down to portion control. I think that, and I'm what I call it a real food advocate. So, when I want to use butter, I use butter. I don't use light butter. When I want to use cream, I do so in very, very small amounts. But I use the real thing, and I just scale down my portions, and I will even go so far as to actually serve dinner on smaller plates, and that's actually helps us.
Well, we commend you for a fine work and a tasty book, if nothing else. Poor Man's Feast, a love story of comfort, desire, and the art of simple cooking. Thank you so much, Alyssa.
Thank you so much.
Good to talk with you, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
And tomorrow on this show, our guests will include Jim Bernhardt, the man who just left his post as the chairman of the Shaw Group, the company he founded. Was Baton Rouge's only Fortune 500 company. If you've been down Essen Lane, you can see that the sign's already down. It says CBI now. Gone is Shaw, but Jim Bernhardt is far from gone. He remains a major force in this community, and there are some who say he will run for governor in 2015. We'll talk with him about his political aspirations. He is a former chair of the Louisiana Democratic Party, so it will be fascinating to see where Jim Bernhardt goes next. But he is one who will not rest on his laurels. He's only 58 years old, so there's a lot of gas in the tank for the man who made a fortune in this community. And despite some overtures to leave Baton Rouge, he stayed here with his company, and now it is owned by other people. But Jim Bernhardt is still around and has now opened an office downtown, and he will be with us tomorrow, as will Debbie Elliott. You may have heard her this morning on Morning Edition on National Public Radio and WRKF, the veteran reporter for National Public Radio. She has spent lot of time in Louisiana since the Deepwater Horizon tragedy of 3 years ago, and she will be here to talk about the latest, including the court proceedings in New Orleans. And Debbie Elliott, is always a pleasure. She comes to Baton Rouge frequently, and she will be with us tomorrow on this show after we hear from Jim Bernhardt. So we hope you'll be with us tomorrow. Until then, for Kevin Gallagher, we thank you for listening today. Hope you have a great Monday, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.